Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
It's Big Love, Pop Art, and Fun Times from the Wilson World Studios in California, USA. It's Big Pop Fun. Here's Tom Wilson.
Thank you, Jeff Harlan. Thanks so much. Welcome to the Big Pop Fun Podcast with Tom Wilson. I am Tom Wilson, your lovely, live and limber host, though I'm not live or limber. But welcome to another magical sleigh ride of enchantment and wonder as we decide one more time to side with love and laughter and positivity and slight laryngitis, because Tom has been using his voice an awful lot. Hey, but that's pardon me, that's good news in the life of an actor like myself. I don't get many opportunities, folks, to talk about those. I mean, actors, we love to talk about, of course, the projects that we're involved in. And if they're not very important, you don't even say the title. You just say, I'm working on a project. I have some projects in the mix and some on the back burner. The back burner projects include shopping for food and looking for parking spaces, but they are projects nonetheless. So I've been working, which is unheard of for a magnificent entertainment machine like myself, unheard of to be in a few things, well, a couple things, couple and a voiceover thing at the same time. But hey, while I'm there, while I'm doing it, I have to talk about it because it's going to be, it's just over. And, I have to take the opportunity because in a month I'll be back to just, you know, telling you I played a monkey in a cartoon. So I finished up the Heat. It's got a name now. Did I mention that before? It's got a name, The Heat, with Sandra Bullock and Melissa McCarthy. I think it's actually going to be a funny movie directed by my old buddy Paul Feig from Freaks and Geeks fame and Bridesmaids fame and many other fames. Paul is a terrific guy. Quite a gentleman, he's really smart guy, always dresses to the nines, which is terrific. In the middle of that Boston heat wave, Paul was wearing impeccably pressed seersucker with a tie every day, which I don't know, I admired, since I was wearing an I'm with Stupid tank top with the finger pointing up at my head. But that was that movie that I finished, and I finished also the thing that I was talking to you about, because I've been very busy doing a show called Zack Stone is Going to Be Famous, which is coming out on MTV. I think that's going to be in January, but check that out, because very usually I would say something like, and I just finished a TV series where I'm playing a cop in a thing, but don't. You know, that's neither here nor there. Let's start with the podcast. But this one is actually good. Bo Burnham, for those of you who know the comedy scene, Bo is a young and incredibly talented. And now at the end of the show, I see an incredibly hardworking and focused comedian and an actor and writer. And he's playing Zack Stone in the show. And I really think it's good. I know I was giving you time to register shock. And of course I told you about the Vanity Fair thing. So that, hey, look, that's me, but cut me a break. I gotta, you know, talk while it's happening. I've got to talk about my projects, because now they're all over. And now we go and I look into the future like so many actors, and, over the vast landscape, I see a small tumbleweed just tumble across and into an old abandoned diner, like something you'd see in a truck or Viagra commercial, where the guy is out of the middle of nowhere, but he's really pulling it together. I've never seen, I've been in Arizona many hundreds, if not thousands of times, and I've been to very, very remote places. Have you ever seen one of those things where you can actually stop in one of those places with your truck? And it's, yeah, I think everything's been so commercialized. I'm like, where do they, you know, over Dennis Leary's talking about it, because they're really tough trucks like Dennis Leary. Let's get to the podcast this time. Many people email and say, boy, it's so great, the introductions you make. And other people email and say, would you please stop with the introductions, because they're boring me to death, so I fast forward through them anyway. So those people are fast forwarding. Pardon me, little throaty things today, as I told you.
when you first are a comedian and you're opening for people, I have a Guild guitar, an old guitar. It's a red guitar, and it's got these dings on the front, and it's from people throwing nickels at me when I was opening for rock bands in the the late 70s and early 80s. People throw things at you. It's difficult to be an opening act for a big act. Albert Brooks probably copyrighted. He copied and then he wrote it down. A bit that he had on an album about his opening for Richie Havens, which rings true to so many comedians, because he's opening for Richie Havens and it's the 70s or something, and the whole audience is screaming, "Richie, Richie, Richie." And Albert Brooks, a young guy, comedian, comes to the back of the curtain, and there's the man with the headset and ready to open the curtain for Albert Brooks. And he just looks at Albert Brooks and says, "Your name Richie?" And Albert Brooks says, "No, I'm Albert Brooks." And he just says, "They're going to kill you." So that's the experience very often in opening for people. But I was the opening act for many people. And comedians, it is a little better. I opened when I was first out in Los Angeles. I opened for my then roommate, Yakov Smirnoff, in Las Vegas. And we do the show, went well. Came off the stage and was going around, and everyone was just asking permission to talk to Yakov because they thought I was his bodyguard. And I was saying, I don't have anything to do. I mean, you could talk to him if you, "Oh, are you the bodyguard?" I said, I was in the show. You're not his bodyguard? No, I was the guy that went before him. I was in the show. Did you see the show? Yes, I saw the show. I said, I'm the guy. I went up, I had the guitar, I play. I was that guy. They go, oh, hey, you're pretty good. Can we talk to him? So it's tough. But Gary Brightwell is an old friend of mine who is a magnificent comedian in his own right. We met at the Comedy Magic Club in Hermosa Beach, California, and Gary has worked there and across the country as a really terrific comedian. But noteworthily to me, I thought he takes on that challenge of being the opening guy because he's good at it. That's the thing. He's worked with Jeff Dunham. And with Jeff Dunham primarily, and lots of we talk about it. We talk about it, and my voice is tired today, so I'm just going to introduce him. Thanks for tuning into the podcast. I hope you enjoy it, and tell a friend about it. And here's my conversation with my old buddy Gary Brightwell.
It's Big Fun.
Gary Brightwell, the host of Off the Cuff on XM Sirius.
Off the cuff with
Bill Engvall.
Bill Engvall and Gary Brightwell. Yeah.
So you got your name in the title.
Because
it's Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson.
And who's bigger, Big Pop Fun or Tom Wilson?
Tom Wilson is bigger than any podcast, Jack.
I hear you.
So I did your show. So you're doing
exactly.
Show. And we were just talking about podcasting and the whole thing of everyone approaching this now, and every guy that I know who do, and these guys do successful podcasts, and I would say, "Hey, can I pick your brains about this? I would like to go out and just, I'll buy you a burrito and you tell me what it is."
Right.
And you buy their burrito, you get the chips, you have a refreshing drink, and you sit down, and all of them say, "Hey man, you just do it."
Yeah.
Like, what do you mean? I mean, you just get guys, people that you know are interested in, and you just talk to them.
Yeah.
And what, do you edit a lot? Not really. I mean, if the phone rings or whatever, edit it. But you just talk. And they said, even in those conversations where you feel like you have to edit that out, because he's talking about his aunt's house in Maryland and changing the shutters, and you've just, come on. I mean, we got to cut that out.
Right.
So, and they would say, and you don't have the time, so you go, "Well, I'm just putting it out there. I have to. I don't have the time to edit it." And then you get emails of people saying, "That was so amazing, that story about his aunt's shutters in Maryland. Loved that."
I'm amazed at, like I said, we did a show last week. Bill and I did a show. And every show, I always try to find a topic to have people call in, something that will give them a reason to call in. When I'm not doing a show like with you, where, like, today's show is much more of an interview show about you.
How did I do?
You're good. I wouldn't say great. No, it was great because, like I said, I want people to call in to our show who actually would get a chance to talk to Tom Wilson, you know, or, you know, just things like that. But when Bill and I do it, all they want to do is talk to Bill, which is great. I understand the whole beast of the whole thing. But I also want people to call in and talk, you know, about other things.
Yeah, I think on your show, I did my little bit of my Charles Nelson Reilly thing, which is just, I mean, Charles Nelson Reilly would always be on The Tonight Show or whatever show he did. He was fabulous.
Right.
But he was just a font of stories.
Right.
It wasn't really you got to him personally.
No.
And maybe that's by design. And maybe that's by my design, is now you become this guy who anyone brings up the East Coast, anyone brings up Maine, and you just go, you know, I was in the Scouts, and we went on this canoe trip, and you just have the story of this thing, or you have your, you know, five go-to Back to the Future stories.
Right.
That I don't even really know what they are, but people have to remind, oh, do that thing about the thing. And it almost, it's a story about your actual life that happened, but it's sort of becoming a bit, you know? So you have, like a comedian has a specific show, you have kind of, or I certainly do, and I mean, what I mean, Charles Nelson Reilly did, of this, the interviewee guy that I do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
When they go to that, I'll just go, oh, you know, I have a story about that, because I was coming off the road, and it becomes that. And now, like halfway through your show, I'm doing the story about this and that thing.
Right.
And the inner voice is going, dude, are you becoming Charles Nelson Reilly? You know, are you just
the
font of just the shtick story? And then he trips over the rental car, and I was, you know, and
I look at it two ways. First off, I think that when you're, if you're the guy doing the interview, you want your show to be entertaining enough to where, like, you want the other person to do a story that maybe you found very interesting, and you know that the audience, the listening audience, is really going to be interested in it, and you want to just make sure, well, let's get that story in because I know it's funny, and then it'll have a payoff. People will enjoy it, and you'll get feedback saying, ah, I just love that story. On the opposite side, I've done the show with people, and they go, I don't think we were really funny, but yet you get feedback from people saying, that was such a great show, because they go, it's like I'm a fly on the wall listening to two comedians in the business talk about the business, you know, in a sense that I've never even heard, you know, these things before. It's like they're listening in, and they enjoy that part.
Yeah.
And then I'm always amazed at, like I said, the little things that you might say that you think are just throwaway, not even jokes, but just things away. Like the last week's show we did with Bill, our topic was guilty pleasures on your iPod. Songs that you like, but if, you know, if they were blaring out of your car, you'd be like, oh my God, he's got Mandy from Barry Manilow on his thing. Like, so Bill and I were talking about,
don't make fun of Mandy. That's a good song.
It is a great song. That's the whole thing. My theory is, if you're in the car and Mandy comes on the radio, you don't turn it. You'll maybe put the windows up. People don't know that you're singing Mandy.
The shadow of a man.
But it's great.
A face through a window.
That's right.
Crying in the night. The night turns into morning's just another day. Happy people pass my way. Come on.
I know. I don't have
Gary
Mandy
Brightwell,
on my iPod.
You came and you gave without
taking. I don't
taking.
Have Mandy on my iPod.
You don't have
iPod.
Mandy?
I don't. But the one Barry Manilow song I do have is the Trying to Get That Feeling Again.
Of course.
To me, that's the greatest part because it builds up.
Yeah.
I've been up, I've been down.
Sure.
It always cracks me up.
I have early Stive Avenue C from his first album.
Okay.
Yeah, which was more jazzy.
The other thing I mentioned that I had on my iPod that I was like, you know, I don't think I'm particularly proud of, but I have Hanson's Umbop, but acoustic.
It's a fun
unplugged
song. It's
unplugged,
just a pop song.
Unplugged Umbop.
That's right. It's a pop song. It's just easily singable.
Bill
so.
Made fun of me.
Well, what does Bill have on his?
Oh, well, he had some really bad ones too. So then we got bantering and talking about goofy songs, and I said, "Do you remember Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road?"
Of course, Loud and
Loud Rainwright the Third.
Of course.
And that was somebody that listened to the show Rhoda on our Facebook page, oh my God, I totally forgot about that song, and that's the one thing that kind of triggered that. So that's how I look at it. People are listening in, and if you somehow happen to touch a little nerve with, you know, someone in Massachusetts, something like this, it just brings back a memory that, you know, that's the cool part about doing these things.
And you have to kind of have the interview personality, because you can't just go on things and you say, so how's it been going? And he goes, not very well.
Right,
I don't feel good. A couple of auditions last week. Didn't look like they're happening, and I did poorly. Yeah. And now I'm questioning the whole thing. You can't do that. You have to bring it.
But now everybody has a podcast.
I know.
That's how I kind of feel like I'm coming to the party way too late.
No, I did too. I did too.
You know,
and both of my listeners are always quick to tell me that it's not too late, Gary. It's not too late. But yeah. I love the fact that in the media today that you and I can sit here and talk on a podcast about the interviewing of an interviewee, of the interview. Like, we're so kind of meta, commenting about the thing that's commenting on the thing that we actually originally commented
on. I had a theory, though. If there was some kind of podcast social disease, like a STD that would be passed around, there would be a group of people that all would have this disease, because I'll do your podcast if you do my podcast. I'll be, you know, it's all these people that were constantly all doing each other's podcast. And if there was some kind of
well, it's people with the you know, the chutzpah,
yeah,
like myself and everybody, to just go, oh, I think things that I say are worth listening to. Right? Just what? Well, where does that come from? The air. You just come up with this. I think that I could just
record the greatest thing about this,
myself talking, and I think that people should listen to it.
Well, people will do that, though. I mean, you know, you'll think, oh, I think I'm interesting, and then people will tell you that you're interesting, that they love your podcast.
They
and
say that to you. They don't say that to
me. Yeah,
they
do.
Very often. Gary Brightwell is my guest, and I should say you're a comedian of many, many years. We've known each other for decades
Yes,
now.
Yes, exactly.
A very, very famous comedian across the country, and especially in Southern
famous,
California.
Famous, no, but I don't think I'm famous.
What are you?
I'm just a guy. I'm a good working comic.
Yeah.
That doesn't make waves.
Where you?
That's how I've stayed in the business.
Really?
I come in on time. I do my time, and I don't make waves.
We're gonna get to the comedy work that you do. But are you a California guy?
Born and raised.
And where in California?
Redondo Beach, California.
Really? And you still live there?
Still live
there.
You
were such a beach guy.
Yes.
When I first met you, you really embodied. I don't mean that Troy Donahue. I don't mean the blonde guy with the surfboard under his arm. But I mean that that the easy way of taking things, the kind of little laid-back California thing, living down at the beach. We met at the Comedy and Magic Club down there in Hermosa.
If I don't see it, but it doesn't happen, that's how
right,
I look at it.
Whatever.
The news. Hey, if I didn't see it.
Yeah, and just kind of a sunshiny, and everything's good. It's all good.
It's good.
So that is, well, what did your dad do there in Redondo?
My dad was a tool and die maker. My dad's kind of really I'm the first Brightwell in the family to ever graduate college.
Uh-huh.
My dad started out as a sweeping floors at a business called Trio Tool and Die, and eventually became a tool maker, and then became a journeyman, and then became shop manager, and then ended up owning the company for many years. He worked his way up from sweeping the floors to owning the company. It's like really like an American dream.
Absolutely.
Story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And do you have a house there in Redondo?
Yeah. Yeah. I grew up right there in Knob Hill, like five minute walk, half mile from the ocean. And
isn't it amazing that Redondo Beach, and you could be a tool and die maker and work at a plant at that time, and just like so many people in Huntington Beach and all these beach communities that were, but you imagine these big houses, the beach house, and the servant, some Beach Boys concert is on their front lawn. And when you go down there, it's suburbia.
It's just suburbs.
It's suburbia. It's just
big houses, small houses.
Yeah, quote unquote, regular people
yep.
just doing their jobs and having these now these houses.
And a lot of people don't realize that there was so much industry down in that area. There was like McDonnell Douglas aircraft.
Well,
in
all
Long
those
Beach.
Hughes aircraft, Northrop, TRW.
Yeah.
All those things.
All that kind of stuff. So my dad's shop was right down there in Hawthorne, and he just worked, you know.
And did mom work?
Mom was a stay-at-home mom. I grew up across the street from the elementary school. So I was able to come home for lunch, which many of the kids were like, "You are so lucky. You live across the street." And I was like, "Well, that's no big
deal." So on these breezy days, a minute from the beach in California with the American flag fluttering outside the elementary school, Gary with his book bag crosses the street have lunch made by mom.
My favorite memory is growing up, like way back during when the World Series would be played in the daytime during the week. You know, they had no idea that, you know, they could make so much money by playing the World Series or professional sports late at night, you know, or at, you know, prime time. So that literally, I would go home for lunch. My mom would, you know, it'd be September, October, starting to get, you know, cool. You know, Southern California, it was like it's in the 60s and it's overcast and people are like, it's winter.
Yes.
But you know, I would like walk across the street for lunch. My mom would have a grilled cheese sandwich, tomato soup, and I'm watching the World Series.
So you got out of high school. When did you start doing stand-up? Because I knew you were pretty young when we met.
Yeah, I got out of high school. I was always a huge comedy fan in high school. Steve Martin albums. Like I said, I would tape comics on the VCR. When the VCRs came out, they were huge.
So all the different sets of people, you were taping them.
Gary Shandling's and Seinfeld's doing their Tonight Show, really? 5 minutes. I had one tape of everybody's stand-up. So I was always a huge stand-up fan.
And who surprised you at that point? Were you taping the guys that you didn't even know? Like the first set or whomever?
Oh, yeah. I was taping guys like A. Whitney Brown and Kevin Meaney and guys like that, you know, Howie Mandel. People were like, oh, my God, have you heard of Howie Mandel? People were like, I don't know what you're talking about. So anyway, I was a huge comedy fan. Went to college, and while I was in college, I got a job at the Comedy Magic Club, which was literally 10 minutes from my house in Redondo Beach, in Hermosa Beach. Yeah. I got a job as a waiter.
Oh, so I met you there, but I met you, I suppose I was a comedian then. You weren't a waiter then. I mean, you were.
No. I'd moved past being a waiter, and I was like the house MC.
Oh, so you were a waiter there. Just at the place where comedians were, you liked
and
comedy.
Loving every minute of it because I would walk back in the kitchen and I'd be like a little starstruck and people are like, what's up? And I go, oh my God, A. Whitney Brown just walked in. Mm-hmm. And they're like, who's that? And I go, he's a great comic. And Gary Shanley would come in and, you know, and then eventually you would make friends with, you know, they would just, you know, because you're to the wait staff, you know, so you made friends with the comics. And I was like, I was in comedy heaven. I was like, you know, able to watch guys doing their sets and I would stand in the back of the room. I would just go, God, just to how amazing it would be just to be able to do 5 minutes.
Did you start, like, did you open a notebook and start writing things down?
I had always written stuff down, but I never thought I could ever put it on stage. And then as a waiter, the house MC at the club would go, hey, I need somebody to introduce me from the back of the stage, you know, from the sound booth. Will you do that? And I was like, yeah, okay. So I would be comfortable on the microphone there. And then he would go on vacation, and they had nobody to fill in. So they asked me one day, hey, would you like to do this? All just you have to do, yeah.
Get on stage, like welcome everybody.
Say you have a good personality. All you have to do is, like, welcome everybody to the show. Maybe, you know, say who's celebrating something. If you celebrate your birthday, just say, we're glad that you're here. Bring on the first comedian. Get everyone's intros. Bring on the first comedian. Keep them to their time, and just run the show. And I was like, oh, okay. When it happened, I was like deathly afraid. I have video of it. It's really funny, where I'm just shaking, reading stuff from a card, you know, of like who's coming up next week, and
yeah.
And it was when he would go on vacation, I would do it like for a week, and by the end of the week, I was a little bit more comfortable with it. And then he'd come back from vacation, and then I wouldn't do it for like 6 months.
Yeah.
Until he was going to go on vacation again. And then it was like starting over again. And it was brutal for me. And then finally, he moved on, and they made me the house MC. And I was still doing where you're from, what do you do, birthdays, like this. And it was comedian Pat Hazel who told me, pulled me aside, and he says, you have an amazing thing happening here. I go, what do you mean? He says, you have 5 to 10 minutes on one of the premier comedy stages in the country. You need to be writing jokes. You're a funny guy. You need to be writing jokes and putting material together. So you're not doing where you're from, what do you do. You're doing stand-up comedy as the opener and bringing everybody on, hosting the show. So at that point, I started really kind of working at it and trying stuff out and doing it. And it just ended up building. And then I would be like, oh, to be able to do 15 minutes of comedy. And then next thing you know, you're doing an hour, you know, when you're after you've moved on and you're doing an hour, and then you come back to some place and they go, hey, can you do 5 minutes? And you're like, that's hardly anything.
Right.
Whereas years ago, you were like, oh, just to get to 5 minutes.
If I could survive for five minutes on stage. And then you do say, like, I barely, like, say my name for 5 minutes.
I know.
I don't even know how to approach
I know.
That.
My girlfriend, she was taking, like, a speech class. And she was like, we have to talk for 5 minutes. And I go, you're going to be amazed at how fast this goes by. She goes, ah, I don't think so. And I go, 5 minutes is three things. All it really is three things.
Right.
And she would like come back. She goes, oh, my God, I never even got to this, and this. And I go, I told you.
Right,
you know,
right.
It's really it's amazing how when you start building it, how quickly it goes.
But you have that. But you were the host there. For a very long time.
Many years.
Now, were you writing new stuff weekly or trying to get it up on stage?
But once I got something that was really good, I would try to keep it in
there. Right,
you know, and then eventually there was so much repeat business coming to the club. People were like, God, you're doing the same jokes every time. I was like, well, you know, it's hard. This is a difficult thing.
Right, right.
You know, people didn't realize
I still quote sometimes, and I give you full credit, not on stage, but talking to people, your Barbie joke. About Barbie's actual measurements?
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Do you want to do it or should I do it?
Barbie's actual I read in the paper where she turned 50 or something like that. The Barbie doll had turned 35 or 40 or something like that. And somebody had figured out that her actual if Barbie were to be a real-life person, her measurements would be 39, 23, 33. And I go, which got me to thinking, you know, if Ken was a real person, he would have to have a really nice car.
Right.
Because let's just say Ken is very smooth.
Yeah,
we're not talking
he's a smooth
about
operator.
His. Yeah. So yeah,
but that kind of thing. So but that host you met all these comedians.
That was the greatest thing.
Yeah.
I got to watch the best of the best because that was like one of the premier. There was like only two or three really premier comedy clubs. There was comedy clubs all over, but. People really wanted to work the Comedy Magic Club. They wanted to work the Punchline at Atlanta. They wanted to work Mark Ridley's club in
Detroit.
In Detroit. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was like, you know, a good five good clubs throughout the country that people really
it's difficult
wanted to
describe
work.
How hot that room was.
There was amazing shows because we were in L.A., but we weren't in L.A.
Yeah, it was Hermosa Beach.
It was Hermosa Beach. So
45 minutes from town, maybe, if you're coming down from
35
Hollywood.
35 to 40 minutes from downtown L.A. or Hollywood. So a lot of the comics loved to come down there because they could do a show and they didn't feel like there was a jaded Hollywood audience, you know, with producers and stuff, you know, just kind of judging them. This was really – it was like doing a road gig but you were in town.
And it's still like that. I mean, still it's fun. It's great. It's sometimes, you know, it's almost a pain in the neck because you're working there or headlining and every night there was, hey, Tom, listen, would you mind – if Ray Romano gets up and does about 10 minutes before you, sure, I guess. Listen, Gary Shandling just showed up. He's going to do like 15.
There was
so
nights.
Every night.
There were nights where it would be like Larry Miller, Paul Reiser, Gary Shandling, you know, and those and that, and then you still had whoever else that was booked on the show,
right,
that week,
yeah.
You know. And so when I started booking the club years later, I mean. You would get, you know, just basically tape submissions and people that were, they go, oh, I work these clubs like this. And then I would watch it. I was like, well, that's good, but it's not, it's not what we have. And people were like, I don't understand why I can't get in. And I said, well, because there are nights where you're going to have to follow Seinfeld and Shandling.
Right.
Can you do that? If you think you can, then okay, come on down and I'll give you the audition and see if the owner likes you. I go, but I can't, you know, based upon the caliber of comics that we have down here on a regular basis, you being the a middle act at a Funny Bone in Des Moines, it was a different beast at the time. You know, I'm not putting down anything about Des Moines and the Funny Bone at all. But
I was that kid. At one point, I was that kid.
It was just a different
and
beast.
But you're coming into town and saying, hey, I want in. You know, look at this. I throw a 95-mile-an-hour fastball. So everybody check this out.
Right.
And everyone is trying to tell you, I'm not sure, you know, where you had the fastball before, but right. Like this is the pros, man.
Right.
Everyone is throwing 98 and an amazing breaking pitch.
It was there was amazing times and amazing shows down there. And like I said, when you started coming down, you know, you did great right from the get-go. So
Well, yeah. But it was just an amazing place to be.
But I think you waited a while.
Oh, I didn't go there. Yeah, I didn't know.
You didn't come
because I knew
there.
That was the place. You know, everyone would almost talk in hushed tones about it.
Because
you know, I was a regular at the Comedy Store and doing whatever, the Improv and all those places. And what's this? Boy, I hear great things. This Comedy Magic Club in Hermosa Beach. Oh, yeah. It's just, it'd be great to get in there. But wow. Oh, the biggest guys go up there.
But it's so funny because, we always had biggest guys. But there would be some weeks where I was like, the headliner was like a juggler or something. And it would be like, this isn't that great of a week, you know?
Yeah.
But it would always be peppered with, you know, like I said, a Seinfeld would come in and he was working on a Tonight Show set.
Yeah.
You know, and like at the time, that was one of the big things because at the time, when you would do like the Tonight Show, the comics would want to come down there because they got a better read of what America.
It seemed like an all-American
like
audience.
Like I said, it wasn't a jaded
Hollywood
audience. It was more. If the set went well at the Comedy Magic Club, it was going to go well on television. And so, actually, the guy who used to put the comedians on the Tonight Show would want all the comics that were going to be on the show to come down and run their set in Hermosa Beach.
Mm-hmm.
So Jim McCauley, who was the guy, he would come down all the time. And
I got the Tonight Show out of the Comedy Magic Club.
Yeah.
Out of Jim being there.
Yeah.
And so from there, though, your relationships with these big comics leads to a normal thing, but unusual to people because you've gone off and been the opening act for so many big comics.
They would
meet you at the Comedy Magic Club and pick out you and say, hey, Gary, do you want to come to this gig? So you go from being the waiter guy into the host and MC, and then it's a pretty big jump. Not that you're the headliner, but it's a pretty big jump to, hey, will you come to this place with 1,500 people in a big theater? I mean, who was the first guy that started that invited you to come out?
That would take me along.
Yeah,
I did a lot of opening in especially in theaters. I opened a lot for Jeff Dunham.
Okay. So you knew Jeff from the club.
Right.
And Jeff says, would you come to the Des Moines Performing Arts Center or whatever?
Right. And I think where my ability lies right now is the fact that I did so many years at the Comedy Magic Club as the host, coming out, nobody in front of me, coming out to a cold audience, grabbing their attention, telling some jokes, doing a good job, and then getting them ready for whoever was going to be next.
I'm really
good at hosting. It was something that I learned through the years,
just through doing it a million times.
Right. So, like I said,
the way to approach things, because everyone has been to a show where sometimes and I've opened for bands and all sorts of things where you are the opening guy.
Right.
It's like, I'm not sure what his name was. Even if your name could be on the marquee, your name is in the program and everything.
Right.
Oh, that opening. Yeah, that first guy, that was pretty funny.
Yeah.
Or he was whatever. He's funny.
Right.
Funny, the first guy. So you, for so many guys now, are...
Yeah, I open for on a not a regular basis, but, you know, on and off, I open for Brian Regan.
Mm-hmm.
We do theaters with him. He has a he's really great because he likes to spread the wealth. He's got like a handful of guys. He's got like five guys that he uses to open for him. Mm-hmm. So there's a guy in named Kermit Apio, like uh-huh. that, from Seattle that opens for him.
So you're not close to Kermit. You just you
know, I don't.
You're trying to bump Kermit.
Kermit
off
and
now.
I know each other, but we know of each other, but we've yeah. never personally met. But he also uses Joe Bolster.
Is Joe still?
Yes, Joe Bolster's. I think
oh
he
my
lives in
goodness.
In Texas somewhere.
Does he?
And he'll open for Brian. Brian uses his brother Dennis Reed.
Sure, Dennis has been on this.
Yeah, and so yeah, he uses Tom Ryan. So uh-huh. there's like a handful of guys. So I'm lucky. I'm blessed enough to be one of the handful yeah. of guys that Brian uses, and those are fun. Got to be crazy spick and span clean for his show. Which I'm not really a dirty comic as it is, but you know, you kind of watch, you know, when you step out on stage and you look at the audience and you got a 9-year-old, you know, because Brian works spick and span clean and he's got a following to the fact where people are happy to bring their whole family to, mm-hmm. and they'll listen to Brian's, you know, CDs and DVDs
right.
with the whole family and stuff. So you look down and you go, okay, I'm not going to do. You know, this kind of material. I'm gonna.
Well, one dirty guy buys one ticket, but a family of clean people buy five.
Exactly, exactly. That's why.
And they buy probably a T-shirt or a DVD on the way home.
A DVD and yeah, exactly. So that's the great thing. And then I open for Bill Engvall.
You've done a lot with Bill.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I've done. Bill's been he's been very very good to me.
No, Bill was in the blue collar tour
blue
and everything
comedy.
With Larry the Cable Guy and with
yeah,
with
he's
Jeff
one of
Foxworthy.
The original. He was Foxworthy, Larry the Cable Guy, Ron White, Bill Engvall.
Uh huh.
And Bill and I became friends, much like you and I became friends years ago at the Comedy Magic Club.
Well, Bill and I became friends, in fact, yeah. at the club. Yeah.
So, and he was like, oh, maybe like 6 or 7 years ago. He was like, hey, do you want to just come start opening for me on a regular basis? And I was like, yeah. And so that went well, and then he and I have always been really good friends. We became like really great friends.
And Bill's a great guy, by the way.
Awesome.
Everyone already knows
yeah.
that, and by seeing him on TV or whatever, but he's really a terrific guy.
Yeah, and so like if Bill's doing a television show, like I said, we did like Lingo. Bill was the host of a game show network show,
yeah.
and he was like, oh, I have a guy that writes jokes for me. He'll be perfect for this. And so I get lumped in, and now I'm writing for Lingo, you know, and then that doesn't work out, and we finish the episode, and that doesn't get picked up, and then like maybe Bill might have another project, and they go, hey, I have a guy. So I've like written on a bunch of shows that Bill hosts, which has been great, you know. Like I said, and thank God for Bill, he's you know to take me out of.
Well, Bill's. I remember I was on a morning radio. You know, you're in some city somewhere. Let's say it was Kansas City.
Right.
I don't know where it was, mm-hmm. but I was on morning radio, and. And Bill was doing a call-in because Bill was coming in that weekend to do one of his concert shows.
Right.
So I'm doing a club with about 300 seats. Bill's doing an arena with who knows what, 1,500
right.
seats, something like that.
Right.
So it's time for Tom to shut up so that they can do the Bill. They want to keep me on. Oh, stick around because you'd be great, you know, another segment, but we're going to do Bill. So I'm just sitting there quietly with my headphones on, and they're talking to big comic Bill Engvall, and Bill, you're doing this thing. And the radio guys go, yeah, Tom Wilson's here also. He says over the phone, Tom's there? I say, hey, Tom. So we start talking, and Bill, being a great guy, goes, hey, folks, you know what? I know Tom's there, and I know he's doing the funny bone or whatever. Listen, go to his show. If you were thinking right. about mine, I mean, you could come to my show and go to his, but definitely go to Tom's show.
Yeah.
And that was just, so, you know, it was
yeah,
funny, but it was so generous of him.
He's
you
so,
know,
he's,
it's
a,
just,
he's such a generous guy.
It was just very nice.
Yeah.
It was very nice. So you're doing a lot because Bill does a lot of shows, you know, himself. I mean, apart from the blue collar thing.
Yes. Yeah. The blue collar thing only has lasted. When you see everybody together, they only did, you know, people think that went on for like 9 and 10 years. It was like only like 3 years that they did it, you know, at all the arenas. And then they recently, you know, not disbanded, but like they all do their own personal concerts. And then they just recently went back, and it was like Foxworthy, Larry the Cable Guy, and Bill doing, you know, like arenas, like 7,000 to 12,000, 15,000 seat arenas. And they did another little movie. Now they're all back doing their own thing again.
So you're not, you know, so you're not really one of the blue collar guys, but you would be like blue tank top.
Exactly.
Whatever's under the shirt, under the work shirt, would be like the undershirt.
But I don't consider myself like a blue collar comic, but because I'm open for bill on a, you know, they kind of put me on, like, so they play me on the, you know, on the blue collar channel on X.
Well, then you're a blue collar comic, buddy.
I guess I'm a blue collar comic.
You're working with Bill.
Thank God.
He's blue collar. Yeah, absolutely. And you're on the blue collar radio.
Yeah, and that was
your show,
thing.
Off the Cuff.
Off the Cuff with Bill Engvall and Gary Brightwell. We do a weekly show, tape it, record it on Monday, live.
Is it fun being the opening guy, or do you want to be the headliner guy? You know, does it get like I mean, I'm sure they treat you well.
Yeah.
You do okay. No, you know, you're doing just fine. You're paying the bills doing that. Do at this point, are you saying to, and I don't know what the answer to this is, you know.
Right.
And I have a lot of self-talk myself about whatever. Do you say, I'm in an active plan to be the headliner guy, or are you saying, you know, I like doing it, and it's enough time, and that hosting thing that I feel, that's in my wheelhouse.
Yeah.
I'm good at that, and I enjoy it. Do you just want to do that?
If I had the perfect situation,
yeah,
it would be opening for the likes of people like Bill Engvall and Brian Regan and other people, doing theaters and stuff like that on occasion, and then also co-headlining or being the headliner, which I do now. Like, I'll headline clubs in San Antonio and things like that. Even though I'm like not a household name, I got a good, you know, 45 to an hour.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, exactly. So, you know.
Absolutely. The people come out and it's good.
Right. Exactly. They're going to come and they're going to see a great show. They might not know who I am when they walk in, but they're going to walk out having a great show. That's what I would like. I would like to have that the thing where I'm opening for them, but also headlining and working the comedy clubs. Because there's nothing more fun than still doing a room full of 200 to 300 people in a really great comedy club. And you'll be able, you know, for me, I'm able to stretch out. Like I said, when I open for these other guys, I'm doing 20 minutes, 15, 20 minutes, which is great because I can shove in 20 minutes of rock solid bang, 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 bang stuff. When I do a comedy club, I'm able to stretch out a little bit, maybe try some new things that I don't do at the theaters, because I always look at the fact that I have a job to do when I open for guys like that. It's my job to get laughs and get them ready for the headliner. And so I'm not going to go out there with a piece of paper and think, hey, I thought of this. This is kind of new, and try something new. And then
also a theater like that, I don't think people who don't perform realize it's a sort of depersonalized experience for the performer, not so much as a club.
Right.
At a club, the people are right there. I mean, everyone's right on top of you, and it's 300 maybe. So it's really an intimate setting.
Yeah.
Where you know if it's going well immediately. Sometimes the bigger the room, these venues, and you're on a stage and people are 20 feet away from you.
Yeah. If they don't seat the orchestra pit, then you're a good 25 feet from the first person.
And the laughs, you can't hear them quite as quickly because the ceiling is high,
exactly,
or there's some chandelier thing,
right,
and the sound system is unusual, so
right,
the front are hearing the jokes before the back, so a laugh will do this wave thing that comes back.
Right.
So it's...
And sometimes the fact is, like, sometimes people don't want to go in and do a sound check. Bill doesn't do a sound check. I don't think Brian Regan ever does a sound check. He has somebody else kind of go and do that. So sometimes when I'll go out on stage and I'll start, the mic will weirdly cut out or the sound doesn't sound right. And I'm basically there to take the bullet, tell some jokes, but have them get this thing figured out before the guy that they paid to see
right.
steps on stage.
Right.
You know, so yeah. So in a perfect world, I would like to be doing a little bit of both. I'd like to do, you know, 45 minutes to an hour at a comedy club, you know, for 4 or 5 days, and then also supplement that with some really great theater gigs, you know, opening for, you know, the likes of those guys.
Sure.
It would be great, you know. But yeah. It's getting to a point now, I don't know if it's, you know, because the economy, a lot of theaters and stuff don't want to pay for an opening act, or promoters don't want to pay for an opening act, so they'll pay for an evening with Bill Engvall.
And then you and just come
and
out,
so
Bill
I'm not
just
out. Yeah,
comes
so I'm
out,
not
the
even,
mic's on the stool.
Yeah, just a one-person Bill Engvall. Please welcome Bill Engvall. And he walks out, and he does the whole thing himself. Nobody...
That's man. I want somebody to warm them. I mean, not yeah. that I do those. I don't do those gigs. When I do, Gary, and I think a couple
no,
of
but
weeks.
No, but you did. You've opened for like bands and stuff. I don't. I've only did. I would tell you. I only did. I opened for Julio Iglesias about 2 years ago, and I ate it. Oh, I ate it like a free buffet.
It was brutal. I don't really even mean. I don't mean this. In a bad way. Did people speak English? I mean,
well, that's what I didn't get. My deal was I'd known a couple other comics that had opened for them, so I kind of picked their brain a little bit, but nobody really told me that part of it. They just said they're going to be older. You're going to do 15 minutes, and the crowd's going to be an older type crowd.
Yeah.
So, you know, gear your material for that. So I did, and I luckily was doing some shows at some country clubs where I was headlining these country club, and I could do 45 minutes to a crowd of where the average age was anywhere from 50 to 70, you know, people who belong to country clubs mm-hmm. and stuff like that. So I came up with put together a perfect set. I felt, okay, this is exactly 15 minutes. I'm going to stick to the script. I'm not going to, even if I'm not doing well, I'm going to stick to the script. I'm going to do that, you know, so, and they tell me, all right, this is your microphone, night of the gig, this is your microphone. We want you to do 15 minutes, unless Julio wants to go on early. And at that, I go, well, how will I know that? And he goes, I'll be off to the side of the stage with a flashlight. And then you just finish up and introduce Julio. And I was like, well, okay, you know. So I go up and I start doing it, and I'm eating. I'm like getting silence. And then I'm getting pockets of laughter, but nothing where it felt like a theater gig that I was used to opening for these other people. And then afterwards... You know, and then all of a sudden they're getting me off stage, and I'm like, wait a minute, this next bit I'm doing is like 5 minutes. And they're like, no, wrap up. And I'm like flustered with the flashlight going right. off in my peripheral vision, and the audience is really not digging the whole thing. And finally I bring on Julio Iglesias, and finally the guy who hired me was like, he goes, oh yeah, I didn't tell you that at least 2/3 of Julio's audience – English is their second language. Oh, well, that would have helped.
Yeah, so, just a little bit.
I didn't even factor that into my set. I just, this is my set. It's going to, you know, this. I'm talking about golf and things that older people like to do.
Yeah.
You know, and it was, oh my God, I ate it. It was brutal.
There's nothing I like better than stealing another guy's story about opening for somebody. So I'll probably have him on the podcast, and I'll have Harry Basil tell his Julio Iglesias story. But I'm just ripping him off right now. Let's pretend it was me,
okay.
But it was actually Harry Basil's opening for Julio Iglesias story. He's opening for Julio Iglesias. Now, Harry, as you know, has a lot of props in his act.
Visual.
He squirts water out of water guns, and he has powder that he does in a bit that explodes, and all kinds of very physical, visual shtick.
Right.
He brings up people from the audience, and they said, that's fine, you do your thing. But one thing, Julio needs the stage to be absolutely clean and dry at the end of your show because he wears very small, he wears very thin slippers. He likes to hear the beat of the music into his feet. And that's how he does it. You know, like a gazelle moving across the stage and feeling the rhythm of the music in through his shoes. So it must be pristinely clean. And Harry's okay. He puts down plastic and everything for the props. He has a pile of towels, Windex, whatever you need. So he does his whole show. Thanks, everybody. Enjoy Julio Iglesias. And then goes wild cleaning the stage with the towels and everything and gathering up things, the big plastic tarp, and right. pulling up his props and throwing them off stage. And he's, you know, he's just sweating doing this thing. And he's wiping and wiping and wiping. And he's looking at the whole stage. And it looks like it's dry and clean and everything. And the music is starting. And they say, ladies and gentlemen, the man you've come to see. So Harry gets off stage. Now, they've given him and his wife a couple of chairs in, you know, in the mezzanine or whatever, so they can watch Julio Iglesias' act.
Right.
So he goes up, he gets his wife, great, it went well, and they go up to watch Julio Iglesias. And Julio Iglesias opens, and he's walking across the stage like, do all the girls I've loved before, and his foot sticks to the stage. He looks down at his foot. And then he looks off stage to, like, the guy who traveled in and out, and, you know, and he does it again. Like, he's looking at the stage like, what the hell is going on with this? What is this? Come along. And he keeps looking down. And so, you know, in a break, Julio Iglesias goes and talks to somebody. The concert continues. But the guy literally comes up to Harry with his wife in the, can I talk to you for a moment? Yeah. You're fine. Like, you won't be doing the second show. Like, you know, go home. So he lost the gig because somehow the stage was moist or something.
Oh my God.
But he's sitting there in the crowd watching Julio Iglesias sort of keep stopping his feet to look down at the stage. Going, I'm dead.
Well, that was the thing. I kept thinking, wow, this is a great opportunity. So if I do well, you know, I'm looking at Julio's website. He's got shows.
A lot of dates.
He's got shows
right?
in Arizona, New Mexico, and I'm thinking, man, if this, you know, I do well, this could turn into something like, we loved you, you know, and I got, you know, now I got the Julio Iglesias gig.
Well, it's great having you here. I don't want to take up too much of your time. What are you doing? Great. You're not married. You're still a California dude.
California guy. I have a girlfriend.
Isn't it time to really make it official? How long have you been dating her?
Why do you
got to? I'll pressure you on the podcast.
I get pressured.
See, we're recording. How long have you been dating? I'm not pressuring you. How long have you been dating?
We have been dating roughly 6 to 7 years.
You're kidding me now, right?
No, I'm not.
And you didn't marry her after 3 years?
I haven't. No. Why is the 3 years the cutoff point?
I'm just saying, like, three years.
Why would that be a cutoff point?
It's not a cutoff point, but it's sort of, isn't it sort of a make a decision point?
I don't know. I don't think of it that way.
Is it not? No?
She moved in after like 2 or 3 years. And then we've been, you know, we've been living together and it's good.
And she likes that. She's okay with that?
No, she'd like to be married.
but you don't.
I get that. You know, is this going to happen? It's like, yeah, it'll probably happen. And just,
but probably it's not.
But not yet.
Come on. She's announce it on my podcast.
We're all still trying to get through.
What is her name?
Kristen.
Kristen, I'm trying to help you out, Kristen.
Special K.
I'm just Special K.
Yeah.
Isn't it time? Isn't it time, Gare? I like the color you're
she
turning.
She will laugh. I know. What color am I?
I'm just saying nice, matches 6 or 7
shoes.
Years.
Yes.
I'm just saying, is it time to either say, hey, let's have a nice wedding. Are your parents still with us?
Yes.
Your parents are still alive?
Yes, they are.
So, but they wouldn't enjoy your wedding. They don't want you to get married.
No.
Your parents hate Kristen.
No, they don't.
Is that the thing?
They like her a lot.
So they like her a lot.
Everybody likes her.
Everybody likes her.
She's great.
Likes her. You like her.
I'm in love with her, but she's perfect.
All right.
She's perfect.
Just, but not quite.
No,
she is not. No, I'm saying she's not. I'm on your side. She is 99.7%? Percent perfect.
Yes.
For you.
Yes.
And that's good enough.
Exactly. I'm like Wonder Woman when I just block the things with my shield.
Can I ask you? This is none of my business. And I'm not, no, this is not pressuring. Because I'm one of, I have fun with it and everything. I am curious. I'm curious because I was one of those guys, for whatever reason, we come up in our cultures and with our families mm-hmm. and in the people that we end up to be as adults. And when nobody was married, right. when nobody had kids, when it was like I was from Mars, I got married and had kids.
Yeah.
You know, and I just had like a...
Did you meet her here in LA?
Yeah, I met her here in LA.
Not in college.
Not in college or anything. I met her here and... We got married and, you know, had a dog and I had this truck and we just had kids and people were like, what is this Iowa or something? What are you like? What are you doing? Why?
Yeah.
I mean, guys actually would literally ask that. Like, why? I mean, you know, there's. But so I did that. And I wonder at this point in your life, do you think was that just a thing where you felt when you were a young guy, did you feel like I'm just probably. Not you know, kind of marry somebody. It's just is that a part of a California thing?
I don't mean it as
laziness or lack of commitment or whatever. But it's like an image you have of yourself.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I don't know what the thing is. I don't think it's a lack of commitment because I'm committed to the whole thing.
Not really, though.
I am. Now, when she hears this, Tom,
I'll cut
thanks.
It out. If you, I'll cut it out.
Yeah, yeah. You want me to cut it out? And then it's like you talked about earlier. Yeah, and then you're like, oh, I don't have time to cut that out. Let's just put it out there.
I'll cut it out if you want me to cut it out, Gary. I'll cut
just
it out.
Put it out there.
No, I don't want to make you, you know, seriously uncomfortable. Wow. It is. You know, I'm curious about it. I'm curious about
yeah,
it. Because no. I know a lot of people. Look, actors especially. Especially. Are like, that's not my thing.
Yeah.
Do you ever want to have kids?
Yes and no. I don't know. Like I said, I'm almost 50, so it's almost kind of, you know, I'm going to be the...
Kevin Nealon.
Grandpa.
Just had a kid.
In
had a little...
In the walker.
Little baby.
Graduation.
Kevin has a walker. Kevin's on a walker. Kevin's on oxygen. Kevin is old, really. Think about it. Kevin yeah. Nealon, I mean, he's really, really ancient. He must be 2-3 years right. older than me. But he just had a had a little baby.
Yeah. She wants kids. But I think we gotta get married first before kids.
So the idea of taking the kid to Disneyland and having them have fun, somewhat disgusting to you.
No.
Somewhat. Just a little repulsive.
Not at all.
An aspect of it makes you just,
all
I
right,
don't know.
I'm driving to Zales right now to get
Bingo!
Them. See, there you go.
Bingo! I Zales. Talked to Kristen before this. So
you must have.
Head
something
to Zales.
Something
hey,
up.
Gary, we'll end this by saying, every kiss begins with K. I didn't mean to make you uncomfortable.
No,
I just
no, no.
It just it interests me because, as I say, I know.
Did you turn up the heat in here in the
no,
room also?
No, not at all. The AC is on.
Okay, all right.
The AC is on. So, you know, hey, think about it.
It'll probably be one of those, it'll get to a point where you're just like, all right, let's just do it, which I don't want it to be that, you know.
Right. It should be from the heart, right?
Right, exactly. I have a friend of mine who got married, but he was gonna propose to her. And he had a ring, and he had to hide it, and she'd found it. And to her, finally, she was like, are you going to marry? You have a ring like this. And it got to a point where he went and found the ring and threw it at her and said, there's the ring. Let's just get married. Wow. I don't think that's how I want the proposal to be. No.
So that's why you haven't bought the ring yet.
Threw the box at her.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, okay. So.
You don't want that.
There'll be a time. There'll be a time.
Will there?
Yeah. If somehow there was some coal in this room, I could just the pressure that you've put on me.
You'd be
would
a diamond.
Make a diamond, and then
you're all. You were a diamond when you walked in here, buddy. You are a diamond. Gary's a great guy and a comedian of wide and interesting experience, and I hope you enjoyed our conversation. Hey, thanks so much for listening to the podcast. Would you tell a friend about it? Would you consider subscribing to it? Would you... Okay, those are the two options, you know, that I had for you. Thanks so much to Chris and Katie, everybody over at Nerdist. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to everybody at McPherson Guitars for helping me out on my live show. Make sure you come out and see me live. I guarantee you will enjoy it. And I'm going to go have some hot water and lemon, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.